Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
You're right.
Okay.
Well, let me welcome you all to this second session, which will be looking at legacies from previous enlargement. We have rather a large number of speakers, and I know there's likely to be a lot of questions, and Professor Chures will also be acting as discussant. So with no further ado, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Professor Liliana Andonova from the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies in Geneva. Topic of her paper is Greener Together, Transnational Networks and Environmental Protection in Southeast Europe. Professor Andonova.
Thank you very much. And my time just got cut from 20 minutes to 10 minutes, so I'm going to...
Sorry about that.
I have a question mark on the title because it's work in progress. I haven't figured out yet for sure whether we're greener together or not quite. Let me tell you where I'm coming from to this topic theoretically. I noticed that networks, transnational networks of bureaucrats, epistemic communities, NGOs, civil society, are supposed to play a very important part of integrating Europe. And that is according to one of the more significant theorists of European integration, Ernst Haas, and later on multiple other theories elaborated that. Transnational theories of green activism, transnational networks of the mode of governance, and so on and so forth. But surprisingly, the study of networks has been almost completely absent in the study of the integration of the new member states into the European Union. There has been great work on environmental NGOs, especially recent work and previous work on environmental movements and NGOs and how external resources have influenced the development of NGOs in Central and Eastern Europe, but that is different from studying networks as modes of organizing NGOs and how these networks influence the success of integration or the integration process in general. I'm not going to speculate why this absence, but we decided to study networks and how they have influenced environmental compliance, but more broadly, accordance with European norms in the environmental sphere. But what are networks? Again, within 10 minutes, I'm not going to get into a discussion that could last a couple of days. But after much consideration, we decided to focus on networks that have some level of stability. Networks, obviously, very informal, flexible, horizontal, voluntary, reciprocal. So it's difficult to say that networks are stable. But we decided to distinguish networks that exist over time and can be activated for various issues from momentary networks such as, for example, policy coalitions or a twinning project. A twinning project in itself is not a network the way we have operationalized it, but it could be part of a bigger network of environmental activity over time. So we are open also to looking at different types of networks, both advocacy and governance, and how they have influenced our issue areas. So the research questions with which started is, first of all, what networks populate the particular regulatory areas we're looking at. How do these networks, and this is probably the most important question, the middle question, how do they influence environmental politics or state-society relations? Do they empower civil society vis-a-vis the state? And if so, in what ways? And finally, what does this mean for a higher level of compliance or accordance with EU environmental legislation? And that's the question that is most difficult to get because there are always other intervening factors. One always worries about spurious correlations. So when we theorize the influence of networks, we looked at the substantial literature, and we are going to examine two types of influence of networks on state-society relations. One is through transfer of resources, both financial, organization, as well as normative, and the other one through sources of leverage. So networks very often enable domestic advocates to achieve policy objectives which they wouldn't achieve in the absence of network by providing conditional leverage, such as the ability to go to European courts or to get third parties, such as the European Union, to pressure on the government. After establishing whether networks have such influence, we used Thalberg's framework to see, well, if networks have this hypothesized influence, they should also have impact on the level of implementation of European law via both the managerial and enforcement approach. With the managerial approach, this kind of activity should increase capacity, ability to interpret European Union legislation. The leverage that domestic actors get from network could also be used to push for an enforcement approach. And I would be very happy to discuss these mechanisms in greater detail, but I also want to get to the empirical cases, so I wouldn't elaborate more. And Aaron asked me whether I'm going to be provocative, so I'm going to be provocative, at your expense. So my argument here is that we have different worlds, and a little bit referring to Gerda's set up little different worlds of compliance, but this world of compliance could come if we consider the interaction between domestic institutions and transnational networks. I disagree with some of the conclusions, for example, in that very good volume in Acta Politica on state-society relations, that we have weak states and weak societies. I think the story in the new member states is a lot more variable than that. So I think if this first quadrant, strong institutions, strong transnational interests, is the Ernst Haas world, and the Acta Politica is the weak interest, weak institutions is the other quadrant. I'm really interested in these two other ones, that you have much more variable compliance, variable integration. You may have weak institutions in countries such as Bulgaria and Romania, but what about if these relatively weak institutions are counterbalanced by relatively developed transnational networks? And also, for example, I don't believe that countries such as the Czech Republic or Poland have universally weak institutions. In fact, these countries, in my view, have considerably stronger institutions than some of the older member states, but I'm not going to deal with them. We are focusing on Southeast Europe, and we have chosen Bulgaria and Romania not only because of that, but because they're in some sense, as Tanya mentioned before, the most likely case to find impact of transnational networks if we believe the transnational networks could compensate for weaker institutional capacity. And we don't assume that transnational networks, if they exist, would necessarily do that. We hypothesize that there is a high likelihood. But the influence of transnational networks could be blocked by political interests, or, as you have argued, it could not materialize because the government is not interested, so you don't have political venues, or they could be happening in parallel. So there could be a wonderful network taking care of a particular butterfly on an island on the Danube between Romania and Bulgaria, but that particular network could care less about European Union legislation. So the assumption that the network will be activated for the purposes of integration is an assumption, is a hypothesis not necessarily yet supported by empirical evidence. So to study these issues, we selected two cases, chemical safety and biodiversity applied to the Natura site, again, because in these two cases there was a fairly high misfit, so considerable adjustment costs, and we suspected that there is high level of transnational networking, so we wanted to see in these most likely cases what kind of impact transnational networks have. And for chemical safety, the most powerful network which I have studied for many, many years is the one organized by CEFIC, and that was a very deliberate organization of a transnational network. Again, I don't have the time to detail that, since the early 1990s, even before these countries had agreements with the European Union, CEFIC and the European Commission and certain EU member states were working together to put together a network essentially to export EU environmental regulations, simply for the reason that the European industry wanted to safeguard its image, it's very fragile, and also it wanted to level the playing field, the regulatory playing field. So there was a very strong network established to kind of diffuse the norms and teach the East European chemical industry that they have to work, their associations were very much co-opted in the network of the West European chemical industries to spread voluntary norms as well as the norms of compliance with EU legislation as a condition to access European markets. And so when I examined the activities of these networks in Bulgaria and Romania, to my surprise, I knew, I mean, the Bulgarian chemical industry network was very, very active. And this network has really helped the industry to be a major player in the regulatory process adopting EU legislation. I didn't know what they're doing in terms of implementation. And I was surprised, not surprised, but it was interesting to find out that their activities, the activities of the chemical industry network were continuing in terms of helping enterprises get permits for IPPC, for the implementing the IPPC directive, coming up with manuals and training for the implementation of REACH and other chemical safety legislation, while the Romanian network, and I haven't figured out exactly why yet, is much less active. First of all, the Romanian association, PEPACIM, got engaged much later in the trans-European network, I think probably because of a blocking of access by governmental actors, and that network, as a result, has had much less influence both on legislation as well as on putting together compliance issues. By contrast, they're quite active in labor relations and using transnational European networks to influence domestic relations with labor unions in that sector, but not so much in regulatory politics. So that was surprising, but that's what we found. Then, in biodiversity protection, specifically we found that, as my co-author says, there is a network for every butterfly. So a lot of networks. And so we distinguish between three types of networks, some that are kind of managed by international organizations such as WWF or Greenpeace or other major organizations, others that are much more European in nature, and others that are even sub-regional, essentially very much related to Southeast Europe or Central Southeast Europe. And we decided to choose one of those, CEWEP. It's centered in Hungary, but it really has a lot of members in that region, 20 NGOs from Romania and Bulgaria participating, so we thought that this is a fairly regionally localized network, so we were interested to examine its activities. And since I only have 3 minutes, which are probably at the moment two, what I wanted to summarize about this network is that, very interestingly, this environmental network has very similar means of creating a network and empowering its members to that of the chemical industry network. Trainings, information, great ability to access the government, great ability to access the European Union decision making, not directly, but through the central representative in Budapest that then has that more direct access with Brussels, and so as a result, but they had a very different agenda. So, what does this mean for implementation? We suspect that as a result of these highly networked activities in the biodiversity area, we are going to see a very high likelihood of calling governments to account for the non-implementation or incorrect implementation of the Natura sites. And if our theory is right, we are going to see a very close linkage between infringements and how infringements were started. In other words, in biodiversity, we expect to see infringements that were started by third parties rather than by commission observations or by just lack of communication. By contrast, in the chemical industry sector, we expect to see relatively low non-compliance. And if such non-compliance exists, it could be more as a result of a European Commission observation rather than civil society action, because civil society is not very active in chemical issues in Central and Eastern Europe. So we started looking into some compliance data, and that is not complete yet, but I have just three graphs that I wanted to share. First of all, looking at overall compliance level in 90, 2008 and 2009. So since these two countries have become member states, as you will see, they're among the best performers. But don't be fooled. So only Netherlands is better than Romania and Bulgaria. but really, don't be fooled, because this was the case also for the Czech Republic, Poland, Hungary, and all the Central East European countries immediately after the accession, partly because in order to accede, you pretty much have to comply with the European Union legislation. And as you can see, in 2009, the number of infringements have increased substantially. They immediately doubled, both for Bulgaria and Romania. But also what I wanted to point out, if you look at the other 10 countries, the Central East European countries that acceded in 2004, they're not doing that bad. So I, again, don't agree with the expectations of massive non-compliance in the new member states, partly because in some ways they were better prepared than the southern member states that entered. And so because these member states are somewhere in the middle, if you take Sweden as one benchmark and Italy, Ireland and Spain as the other benchmarks, the new member states are clearly in the middle, and they are not flagrant non-compliance even several years after after accession. Now for Bulgaria, we see, as we expected, a very high number of infringements. But again, remember my question mark is still with for nature protection. Still question mark, because now we are going to investigate the causal linkages. Are these infringements started essentially by complaints of non-state actors, and do these non-state actors have drawn on their networks, on their transnational networks, to be able to table in these infringements so quickly? Within 2 years, you have this many infringements. For chemicals, as I expected, Bulgaria doesn't have much non-compliance, three cases, and the industry has really been very strong in terms of providing capacity and support for compliance, at least formal compliance. It's debatable whether if you go to Village X and the chemical companies polluting, that you would know that in any country, in fact, in the European Union. In Romania, what I found surprising is very high non-compliance in the area of chemicals, which makes me even more curious as to whether indeed the relatively weak involvement of that transnational network had anything to do with that, whether the administrative process is so controlled by the government. I really don't know to what extent this correlation is spurious, but we are going to investigate it. And again, in nature, you have a fair amount of activism, which I suspect, again, is linked to transnational interests. In terms of conclusions, I want to point out that contrary to the existing literature, we claim that there is a substantial activity of transnational networks in Central and Eastern Europe, which is also variable. It's not for every issue area. And that activity needs to be investigated if we want to understand better what are the mechanisms of integration and unification of Europe. And the domestic influence depends both on the degree of the networking activity and its ability to interact with domestic institutions. We would plan to further investigate the mechanisms of this compliance of these networks might be able or not able to induce. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Our next speaker is Aaron Buzagani, who's from the German Research Institute for Public Administration. The topic of his paper is Avoiding the Eastern Syndrome, Conditionality and Post-Accession Compliance in the New Member States.
So, thank you for inviting me, for being here. I'm continuing pretty much the line we just heard about compliance and post-accession compliance in Eastern Europe, and basically the question, what happens after after this conditionality triggered accession process. And I'm looking to the implementation of environmental policy after accession. So I will talk shortly about what this, this sort of strategic difference between post-accession compliance is to compared to other compliance issues. So there was this process of conditionality before these countries entered into the EU. I will show you some quantitative indicators, basically partly the same we just saw from Liliana about are these Eastern European countries doing better or worse, and then I will look to, and I will find that we cannot really have a general picture, and we have to look, take a qualitative focus, and my work is on the implementation of 6 year EU environmental directives, and I'm trying to get a sort of an explanation from looking closely to this this directives before accession, so the conditional period, and what happened afterwards, and try to find there are some patterns of compliance and non-compliance. The explanation is, in a way, what I'm trying to put forward is there is, well, not really surprisingly, there is domestic structures and external influences interacting, and I'm questioning very much this general picture of, you know, strong states and weak societies. There are huge differences with it, even within countries, but not only within countries, but between different environmental sectors, this will lead to some conclusions. Well, we talked in the beginning about this idea of southern or Mediterranean syndrome. This was haunting the EU after the southern enlargement. But the EU has learned, of course, from its mostly negative experience, and with Greece and Spain and these countries, and put up some new incentive structures for these countries before accession, and. Sort of the big question is here, like, what happens afterwards? And of course there are optimist and pessimist scenarios. The optimists would say, okay, yes, the Commission mainly was doing, and networks, so Liliana was talking about, did a lot of work and good work, and of course after accession we should expect these countries to comply quite well. And then the pessimist scenarios is also what we talked in the beginning is mostly that, yes, this is only paper compliance. We have structures without really substance, and this will all be washed away once the sort of compliance pressure of the EU is away. And scholarship is also quite in the determinant. While people looking to quantitative data tend to see that there it's sort of quite good, as we saw, but people looking to more closely to the detailed questions tend to see that it's really wanting and problematic, and I will try to show that there are big differences in what happens, and this depends on a number of factors, but first let us look to like most common explanations why accession and environmental accession in particular should be a failure. So one question was this goodness of fit argument. So this different legislation, which is sort of forced up on Eastern European countries, it implies huge costs, and so there is no way of these countries that they really can implement it really well. Another big problem is state capacity. Of course, this varies. There is large technical expertise in these countries, of course, but then. The state is in a way a problem and a solution as well, and it's very difficult to sort out like how this really works and what kind of capacities of the state are we looking really. Another weakness was, of course, one of the most important ones, the weakness of non-state actors. This is of course also very differential, but on one hard regulated parts, industry, who has to carry all those costs. Is of course not always in the solution not always having this finances, and of course on the other hand we should have NGOs who press their governments to implement EU legislation, and this was usually seen quite weak in Eastern Europe, so there are big differences. And yes, another problem was a lot of people were saying that EU capacity building was very focusing, we heard that, on the technical issues. and well, the legitimacy of it was sometimes problematic. So how so this might also be sort of bad science, or at least indeterminate science about for compliance after accession. But what we see afterwards is, and looking to compliance with EU environmental law in the years from 2003, is that there was no real big increase in non-compliance. So to the contrary, there was a steep decrease in a way. So which is, you know, keep in mind that the number of member states increased by 12 in this time. So this is first, of course, very very, very general idea that there is no, at least no enlargement effect behind this. Why this is so is of course a question. But might go also one explanation might be the capacities of the Commission to control the implementation and launch infringement procedures. Okay. So there we have a Mac PC compatibility problem. Okay. So what I wanted to, it's basically the same chart we had from Liliana, so say basically showing that there is no enlargement effect. So the Eastern European countries are doing quite well in the beginning. And the question is if it's a question of time, and of course the number of their infringements are increasing quite strongly, a more interesting issue is if we look to these countries, to the group of Eastern European countries, and we see huge differences within this group. So there is Malta, which is okay. I mean, it's not really an Eastern European country, but it's still part of this enlargement wave, having about 50 infringements, and I think Romania was on the other side, which is still having a few of them. Of course, and this is still, there's still a big difference if we, you know, if we have yearly averages. So the question is basically, what explains these differences even within within this group of countries? And what I did, I looked at six environmental directives in Hungary and Romania. Hungary is usually considered as a kind of a good pupil in this question, Romania not so much. And I looked at pre-accession conditionality and compliance of with this EU legislation, formally and also in terms of practical implementation. I looked to directives in water regulation, in pollution, in industrial air pollution mostly, and to nature protection issues. Okay, but this is a sort of problem. I'm coming then. So I had some charts here arguing basically that there is that domestic structures, state-society relations are playing an important role in determining compliance with EU law. And on the other hand, there is also pressure from above, basically from the EU, and also from below, domestic pressure mostly by NGOs, but also by businesses who sort of try to sort out competition issues via environmental legislation, which is important. And so there is what comes from this conclusion is that state capacities are necessary and a sufficient condition for successful compliance. And there are different ways which can lead to compliance. And so I find in this 12 case studies basically three different ways how this happens. So one is clearly through domestic cooperation when state and society are strong. So like the regulated parts and the state administration is really strong. So this is of course the most easy way for complying, but the most lucky way. But we don't really find that often in these countries. The more interesting issues are, of course, where this is not the case, and here there are two different ways which can lead to compliance. One is that basically state a coalition between external and domestic actors, meaning the state and the Commission mostly, and there is compliance through basically pressure from the EU and from which is also taken up by pressure from NGOs. So I conclude in saying that there is no clear no world of dead letters in general in Central and Eastern Europe. I mean, at least looking to these two countries, and it depends very much on state capacity and domestic structures whether these countries implement or not, or just formally or really practically enforce their rules. So external and domestic pressure is also very important after accession to keep these countries to comply after accession has taken place.
Thank you very much indeed. Our next speaker is Claudiu Crăciun from SNSPA in Bucharest. The subject of his paper is Competing for Europe, Europeanization of Green Parties in Central and Eastern Europe and Southeastern Europe. Thanks.
Thank you, James. First, let me thank you, Kevin and Adam, for organizing this workshop. Actually, this paper is basically due to a discussion we had last year, and we're talking about environmental governance in the region. And I just connected the dots because I was doing some work on parties, and so why not green parties? Because they're usually off the radar, because they're small. One part of my argument is that we should look at them because they're small, and because then we can study the impact of size on Europeanization of parties, and secondly, we can look whether participation in government or legislative assemblies does influence in a specific way the parties, and if some parties, they do not have access to the government process or legislative process, if they have an alternative route to Europeanization. And in this case, this is true, because the Green parties from Eastern Europe, even though they are very small, they found an alternative route to be Europeanized. And this is through the membership, or seeking the membership of European Green Party, which is a European Party Foundation. So, just a sec. We all know that the Europeanization literature was focused on executives and policies, because they were most in the forefront of EU governance system. Whereas political parties and party systems came later on as Europeanization objects, let's say. What is the paper doing? There is a lot of work on the impact of European Union and EU generally on parties and party systems. But there is less work done on specific impact of EU governance actors as EGP on specific parties. So this is where my paper fits. And there was work on this subject. Even Kevin, early on in 88, wrote a book about European socialists. I'm sorry, he's not here. More recently, Holmes and Lightfoot, again on the socialists. I wonder why. There is this kind of bias towards socialists, probably because it's considered to be a more integrated party family, a more internationalist. But we'll see that the Greens, they also have a claim to be very internationalist, so for good reasons. So basically, I'm looking to find some variables to explain the influence of European party federations on the parties in the region. And what's the relevance of the research? First, I think the EPF's membership policy is interesting, because they influence the way the parties are creating their strategy and the way they are organized. So we can compare different IPFs and see what's their membership policy. The focus on small and medium parties, I think, is necessary, as I was stating earlier. And related with earlier arguments, I think it's useful to look at parties as alternative policymaking and representation agents. And in Eastern Europe, let me say they have a very difficult task, because before accession and after accession, the bulk of expertise and legitimacy, so to say, is placed not at the party level, but at NGO, think tank, and even bureaucratic level. So green parties, they have a very difficult role or task in saying that we can represent you, we can contribute to the agenda and actually influence it. Lastly, even though this is not the aim of the paper, we can study the impact of international factors in the emergence and stabilization of electoral cleavages. So, Europeanization of political parties, basically we have two main options. First, to approach from the Europeanization theories, looking for impacts. It's a research done on policies and institutions mainly. The second choice is to look at the parties through the comparative politics literature. And I'm saying it's important because they see Europeanization differently. EU stimulus in the first choice is a main independent variable triggering various institutional responses. In the second case, it's mostly an intervening variable. And this is important because these two approaches, they lead you different expectations. In the first literature, you expect more change, and in the second perspective, you expect more stability. I think both approaches have merits, and they can use together, as I'm doing it. Europeanization of political parties in Central and Eastern Europe, compared to the old parties in Western Europe, there was an expectation that the impact would be higher. Why? Because the party systems were in flux after 89. So the parties were forming, they didn't have clear identities, so the scope for influence could be bigger. That's a third approach called the dynamic representation, expecting again a bigger impact. But several authors studied the impact on party systems and parties, and they found there are no significant impacts on the parties in Central Eastern Europe as compared to the old ones. What happened was that there was an impact, but there was, let's say, kind of in the soft impact. For example, the party organization was not changed, but indeed some extremist or Eurosceptic parties kind of softened their tone while accession. Also, for example, a specific cleavage in Central Eastern Europe, communist, anti-communist, was kind of weakening as a result of emergence of new cleavages were kind of similar with the ones in Western Europe. Turning to the European Party Federation as Europeanization actors, there was a lot of work done on this field, especially Ladreg and Jeffrey Clinton. And there is a debate. Do they matter at all? Some people say that they have maybe a symbolic, maybe a programmatic role. Others say that they're very important governance actors and their importance will be likely to increase in the future, thus making membership more valuable for the parties and then maybe having an impact on the member parties. What about the European Green Party? They have a very interesting history. It's one of the earliest federations to be established at the European level, and from the start, they went for a specific membership policy. We call it a pan-European policy. So, regardless that you're a member or not of the EU, you have equal voting rights and, you know, speaking rights even. I'll skip. They will change status in 2011, and they want to start behaving more like a political party instead of a federation. So basically, they are moving to become a truly European party. So until now, they went for an open membership model. Members were accepted after a one-time review process, more parties from the same country, few membership duties and responsibilities. But now they are moving towards a competitive model where there is only one member per country, parties must observe the green principles, organize democratically, and perform well in the elections. If not, a member can be replaced. And this is a new approach, this is a new model based on the fact that in Eastern Europe, we have not only one party competing for membership, but many. In some cases, we have five or six competing for EGP membership. So basically, the European Party Federation has a lot of leverage because it can choose whatever party they want to be members. Green parties in the CE is kind of a sad story for them because only in two countries they have parliamentary representation. So basically, they're not at all relevant in policy making. But this is not a reason not to study them, because in some countries, for example, Hungary, LNP, which is the most important party in the region, Green Party, they had a very good electoral performance, and now they're seen as a potential model for the rest. So just to conclude, following some interviews and some previous work, what are the conclusions? Apparently, the size of the party matters. If you're really small, then you tend to be more open to the influence of the EPF. This effect is even more powerful if there are if the position in the party system is, let's say, not representative. If you're not represented in the parliament, then you tend to get to the EPF as a Europeanization channel. Third, the number of credible party competitors. If you have many parties competing for the same membership, then the influence is bigger. The country status vis-à-vis the EU is, from what I researched so far, this is not an important variable, because parties from Bosnia-Herzegovina, for example, or Albania or Slovenia, they have a similar attitude and openness towards the European Party Federation as the parties in Bulgaria and Romania. Duration of observership also could matter, but also value convergence. And with this, I'll try to finish. Value convergence is very important, because the Green parties, they're not only about protecting the environment. They're also about rights, civil rights, and in including, for example, LGBT rights. This is a problem in Central and Eastern Europe, where the societies are mostly traditional. So parties who are open and active in promoting not only the environmental part of their policy agenda, but also the progressive part of their policy agenda, they have problems with the other parties and the electorates. So this is opens a scope for convergence, but also can mean that they will, for example, they could stay out of the political system for a while. So just to conclude, EGP in this case acts as a gatekeeper of European governments, so it does matter. And this importance is fostered by the fact that there are many competitors on the party landscape. They are relatively small, and they are in dire need of external legitimacy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Our final speaker is Christina Perrau from Oxford University. I'm speaking on environmental NGOs and the power of transnational networks in Romania.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to start by thanking Adam for organizing this family event and for assembling such a splendid team of scholars and practitioners. I agree to take up Adam's invitation, although my research has moved on from studying the impact of the EU on environmental NGOs in Romania, which was the subject of my PhD here at the LSE a few years ago, and I'm now researching judicial reform in this region. But I accepted Adam's invitation because I think there are many lessons we can learn from Romania and Bulgaria, which were sort of considered to be second-class candidates that have traditionally not been of central concern to the West. And I think we can learn from them, draw lessons for the Western Balkans and maybe for the aspirants further east, such as countries such as Moldova. And I will speak more to the academy today because my research is focused on trying to explain what I thought were interesting empirical puzzles that I observed during Romania's negotiations with the European Commission, which took place between 2000 and 2004. And I did in-depth qualitative research. I had several case studies which followed. It was a diachronic series of case studies. They follow each other in time. And I don't want to get into detail because they are described in detail in the paper that was circulated. One was Dracula Park, right at the beginning of the accession negotiations, where the government wanted to build a big sort of amusement park close to a site protected under UNESCO Convention, World Heritage Convention. Then there's Roche Montana, which is still going on, a big gold mining project, very destructive. And there was another case, a Transylvania motorway. And all these cases, what they have in common is that they all featured conflict between the Romanian government and environmental NGOs, environmental civil society. And we have variation between these three cases. In civil society succeeded brilliantly in Dracula Park. They overturned government's plans. They succeeded only partially in Roche Montana because they only managed to sort of delay, they forced the government to postpone giving permits to the gold mining company, while in the Transylvania motorway case they had no success at all. And it wasn't only the civil society but also the European Commission and accession conditionality that were defeated. So what we observe is in these 4 years, there seems to be a sort of civil society power is waning, although little appears to change on the ground. You have the same kind of actors in conflict with each other. The government is negotiating, the same government, the same party in power. So what happened? How can you explain this variation? So now I'll present some of the key findings from my doctoral research project, which may be treated by future research as hypotheses that might be tested on current candidates. One of the first things that I found, and it didn't surprise me because I'm Romanian and I was part of an environmental NGO and I lived in Romania too, is that in its native condition, environmental civil society, we find them almost paralyzed by the communist legacy of abject subordination to the state and also by a lack of resources. Of domestic resources, and their deprivation may be so severe that by themselves they may never get to think about Europe and about the process of accession as an opportunity they can use. The idea doesn't even cross their minds. So, for example, in the case of Roche and Montana, there was a handful of local elites that mobilized against the gold mining company, not because they cared about environmental concerns, but because of property rights issues that arose in that context. And they almost failed in the beginning because they did not seek external allies. They are trying to find allies at the domestic level among nationalistic parties, which have become discredited for better or worse. So they did nothing, this strategy did nothing to improve their chances of success. So I think that the realization that the EU is a resource is a sort of precondition for drawing our resources beyond the domestic scene. And to the extent that these external resources empower environmental NGOs, which then can make changes on the ground, we can say that this is Europeanization. Now, the recognition of Europe and the process of EU accession as a resource has been imported into Romania by Western environmental activists, the Western political entrepreneurs. And it was only then that the domestic environmental movement started to have success. Why do Western activists empower civil society entrepreneurs? They already have access to pan-European resources, so they are able to facilitate resource access to funding that were previously beyond the reach of the local activists. They brought in resistance know-how. They know how to use strategic litigation. You're giving example of that. And the Roche and Montana was one of the first cases in Romania's history where that has happened, where NGOs sued the state in its own courts. I think even more importantly, Western activists bringing knowledge about how to construct strategic discourses, which are transmitted through the media. They are also very good at using media. which they know they are going to resonate with a broader transnational network in which the Western activists are well integrated. For example, in the case of Rocha Montana, in the beginning, the local, the discourses used were framed in patriotic language. We don't sell our country, because the gold, the company wanted to explore to do the gold mining was a Western company. So the discourse was, we don't sell our country. As well as the language of private property rights. And this discourse was entirely transformed by Western activists into a discourse about environmental protection, sustainable development, which they knew from their own experience in the West that would be more likely to attract the attention of actors and institutions that had real power over the candidate government, the Romanian government. So we see that now environment and the locals are very quick to learn from the Western, their Western counterparts. So they are no longer passive recipients of EU influence, but they become proactive entrepreneurs who use the process creatively to their advantage. And one of the common threads that runs through all the cases is that their discourse, they construct discourses in which they rely on accession conditionality and the EU's superior bargaining power over the Romanian government. And these discourses feature not only true and legitimate conditionality,
I'm sorry, I know.
Okay, but also extra conditionality. So when I mean true and legitimate conditionality, by that I mean sort of the rule of law, things that you find in the Copenhagen criteria or in the EU acquis. But they also, these become entangled with extra conditions which the NGOs create from their own agendas and interests, and which cannot be easily traced to any conditionality that the EU as a whole imposed over the candidate governments. I wanted to give some examples of this, but there is no time. And here, Liliana was absolutely right that strategic discourses are important, but on their own, they may not achieve much. I think their success, depending on building alliances with more powerful actors that took up the NGO's concerns, members of the European Parliament, there were civil servants in the European Commission, as well as international organizations such as UNESCO and the Council of Europe. And all these actors, they create what Kick and Seeking in international relations refer to as transnational advocacy coalitions. But they all piggyback on the power of accession conditionality over the candidate government. Now, one important thing I want to point out before I probably have to conclude is that uncertainty, and this is something that has been very little scholars have paid very little attention to it. They are very good, the Transnational Advocacy Coalition is very good to play on the candidate uncertainty over accession. Second-class candidates like Romania experience a high degree of uncertainty over many aspects of their accession, especially in the beginning. They don't know, they are still figuring out what they have to comply with, who they should listen when there are mixed signals coming from the EU. They are often uncertain about their date of accession. They are uncertain about what is happening if they don't comply. What is real conditionality and what is not? And they are very good, transnational advocacy coalition are very good at exploiting this uncertainty to influence the government's behavior. And I think it is very difficult to study because it's a subjective thing, and I think that's part of the reason why it has been left out, but I think we need to theorize that and to pay more attention to how transnational advocacy coalitions interact with the government's uncertainty. Is there time to make one more point?
Yes, go on.
So it is this uncertainty that pushes the government to give in to demands of transnational advocacy coalitions. However, the limits of the transnational advocacy coalition seems to wane once the government becomes more integrated and more networked with the member states. It's not only the NGOs that learn from their transnational allies, but also the member states, the executives, because they are the ones that negotiate and come in contact more often with each other. And they learn, something that is very important, they learn about their prospects of accession. So they become more assured of accession. But this is not enough. It doesn't mean that once they become assured of accession, they can do whatever they want. They still have to get on with their counterparts in the executive networks. So, for example, in the Transylvania motorway case, where the NGOs and the Commission had no success at all, and where the government breached a real condition, this was real conditionality, it wasn't something that was constructed by the NGOs, they learned from their networking with the member states what they can get away with in terms of non-compliance, when compliance is expensive. And it's not only learning from countries like Greece or Italy, they are learning from France and Germany. They learn that they too get around the public procurement acquis. So I think some of the lessons that academic researchers may draw from this is, one, paying more attention to uncertainty and the transnational NGOs' discursive, creative usage of conditionality and also creation of extra conditionality. And I think what I also found, I think it would be very fruitful and it will enrich our research if you also pay attention to the normative implications of this. Because I had some exposure to law over the last 3 years, and one of the things that I've learned is that where law comes from matters a great deal for democracy and for the rule of law. And for example, both in Dracula Park and Roccia Montana, these were projects that the government supported strongly. It had support from the local populations, which was facing high unemployment, economic deprivation, and yet they were overturned by a handful of elites, of transnational elites, and I think that raises questions of the democratic legitimacy and also the rule of law. If extra conditionality was sort of transformed, became a sort of law, well, is it the rule of law or is it the rule of these actors who think that their values are sort of superior to everybody else's? Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
I was asked to give some comments on the four papers, and maybe I'll first begin by saying I think the four papers speak to a couple of issues that I think are really important. One is the caution that we always have to be careful about making too many stereotypes and putting too many countries in a single box, because I think you see here the importance of looking at individual countries and their individual experiences. And as a comparative political scientist, I think something else that was very strongly said is the importance of understanding the structures of individual political economies, the relationship between the government and industrial actors, or government and civil society actors, because that clearly influences what is going on. But the other thing I've very strongly heard about from all of these papers was that there is something to this emphasis on transnational. There is something to the relationship between European actors and the accession or would-be accession countries. And I think a couple of things might be worth, I mean, they're terrific papers and very good presentations. A couple of things that might be worth exploring a little bit further, a little bit more in depth. Thinking about Liliana Andonova's presentation, which is a nice combination of some empirical investigation with theoretical thinking, is to think a little bit more about what does it mean when you're looking at different kinds of networks, because one of the networks you're looking at is a business network. And it's focused on chemicals and the relationship you would expect between a business network and governmental actors is quite different than the expectation of what you might expect from a more civil society kind of actor group. And also, you said it in your own presentation, but you said that the business interests, they themselves may have incentives for complying with EU regulations related to chemicals, either because of image issues or because of issues related to leveling the playing field. And I thought that's, in some ways, you would expect that to be quite different than what we see in a network that is dealing with nature protection, where you don't see the clear win-win benefits or potential benefits for economic actors. So in some ways, I think it might be worthwhile to pay more attention to the different kinds of networks and what that might mean for compliance and also for how you define what is involved with compliance. I also thought here a little bit more attention to this question that I first mentioned about the government-industry relationship in the two countries. Is the relationship between the chemical industry the same in Bulgaria and Romania? And what kinds of structures do you have there? Because that can so much influence what's going on with questions of compliance. You could also ask the same thing about nature protection. What kind of influence do nature protection groups have vis-a-vis the government? Is there any voice? Is there any kind of connection? So I think that would be useful to hear a little bit more about. Aaron's paper. I think Aaron is arguing very strongly for the need to be careful about making overly simplified boxes that we put countries into and assume that we're going to find the same kind of accession compliance issues across regions. I do think we need to dig a little bit deeper, though, here and ask what's going on. This reduction that you're talking about in compliance problems, is that really a reduction, or is it a difference? As you mentioned, maybe it's over stress on the part of the Commission and inability to follow everything that's going on. It could be that you also have on the side of the Commission a sort of a period of, we'll give you a little bit of
grace.
Time, a grace period, thank you. That maybe you don't jump in with hard regulatory compliance mechanisms until you've given institutions a chance to kick into action. The other thing I was wondering about, and it was also in Liliana's paper, the question of maybe you try really hard to comply when you're first a new member, you know, you behave very well as the new member of a club, and over time, maybe you learn some of the rules and ways that you can cheat a little bit better, which also came out in your paper where you were saying one of the things that the new member states learned was that, gee, Germany and France have figured out how to break the rules, let's do it the way they do. But maybe it took a little bit of time. To Claudia Kranzian's paper and looking at the question of the Green parties and the Europeanization of parties. I found this very interesting. I think the European Green Party is an understudied party. It's the first European party to be founded, and I don't think we really know enough about what that means. What does it mean to have a party as a structure as opposed to just a federation, which are what you find among most of the parties sitting in Parliament, European Parliament. I also found your comments about the structure of membership or the rules related to membership extremely interesting, because if you think about how Green parties at the national level were able to change the rules of the game, in some ways, they changed the rules of the game by putting in things like quotas for gender. They put in rules for having rotating positions so nobody got to stay in power too long. It's kind of an interesting, it's a deeper form of democracy in some ways than most political parties have. And it's kind of interesting that they're trying to play this game now at a European level with green parties that are emerging in other states. Just a point that's not really directly on your paper, but I was just wondering, in your studies, did you come across the first ever green party prime minister? Because if I'm not mistaken, it's Slovenia, right?
Lithuania?
Okay. I was just curious because I think in some ways it may be that not just the European side is influencing Green Party thinking, but it could in some cases even be that the new member or the new states have some lesson learning to give back to the European structure. Great paper, and I think what it tells us about changing patterns and structures is very important. Into Cristina Parao's paper and your dissertation, terrific study, very nicely set up with a comparison across the three cases. As I was listening to your cases and the explanation of the failure of the motorway case. The very thing I was thinking as I was listening to that was Germany. It's the same thing in Germany, right? The German NGOs have also not been able to change government policy in relationship to speed limits on the autoways, and they've had trouble getting the German government to agree to CO2 emission reductions for automobiles. So I was also wondering if something might be going on there in terms of the power of a particular industry. And if the auto industry is somehow a different kind of industry than a mining industry, or not. But one of the questions I had is, when you look across the three cases, is there anything different in the nature of the cases you're looking at that might also be playing into the ability of the NGOs to pull on EU networks to try to push for the change that they're looking for domestically. I also thought something that you brought into your paper that no one else did as much or as strongly is this question on discourse and how you construct issues. I think that's a very powerful argument that we need to pay more attention to, that how we think about issues and how they're portrayed and the kinds of frames that are put around them is very, very critical. Maybe we also need to be thinking more about are the ways that we frame issues necessarily equally effective in one political economy or culture as another? Are there also some frames that may be more effective or effectively used in Romania or Bulgaria or Serbia than maybe when you play out the same kind of political argument in France or in the United Kingdom because of the different status of socioeconomic development, the different concerns of societies. Very good, thank you. And terrific papers all around.
Great, thank you very much. Well, we actually now have about 15-20 minutes for discussion, so if anyone's got any questions, comments on the papers, then please, a gentleman there, perhaps if you could identify yourselves.
I've got a few questions. The first question is to I was wondering why you did not look at the Federation, why you did not grab the Federation time also in your research, the time of Med, Eko, the last most long Med in Romania, Dome in Macedonia, in Bulgaria. They had a large surge in support during the revolution, but then directly after the revolution got into huge fights with the European Federation. And it has taken a long time. And I think a lot of the dynamics that we see in these early 90 years are repeating now. I think that will be interesting to see. For Christina, the question for you is in that international influencing, what I miss there is the problem I see in very many NGOs in Romania, and specifically in Romania, is groups internally fall apart very, very soon. There's a lot of internal distrust in Romania, is not only between groups, it's also internal from groups, and continuity of groups over a longer time as a group, not as strong personalities, but as a group, is a problem. It's still a problem after 20 years, although I'm proud to say that the Greenpeace office this time now has two people there already for more than 3 years, but it's the exception at the moment. And what are the reasons that the international cooperation has not been able to bring in the idea of teamwork and team group feeling more in Romania? It was the reason that for me my 2 years in Romania were the hardest 2 years in my life. What I found interesting was your remark about the motorway. We have a recent success story about the motorway cases, the Rozpula Valley in Poland. And it would be indeed interesting to also to compare those two. What the Transylvania motorway, what was different to the Transylvania motorway in this group. I don't think it's so much the opponent. In Romania, the opponent for the Transylvania motorway is Bechtel, and it's a big company that can easily be vilified. That's not the problem. Even in Romania, it's not very popular, I understood recently. Because it's always used to from Moldavia and this stuff. But the what I see is I think you've got on the right track there, because it is the international support for that campaign that is indeed less effective. TNE, the Transport and Environment Network, that is supposed to deliver that network support, is much more oriented in Brussels than it is oriented on the ground. Whereas in Poland, in the Moskula Valley, we had we could draw on the grassroots activity of local Poles that were not so depending on support from TNE. They could draft more on their own people. And that is in Romania, I think, a larger problem. So where the international support for Rosia Montana was very actively orienting on Romania and Romanian decision takers, TNE, more oriented on Brussels, could not do so much. And like you said, Romania was willing to take the beating for breaking rules, which they, in Rosia Montana time, did not dare to do yet. So there's also a time shift there. So far.
Okay, well, there are a number of questions there, and what I'll do is at this point I'll give everyone a chance to respond, and if there were any sort of counter response if you'd like to discuss, and please feel free to bring those up as well. So I don't know who would like to go first. Christine?
Yes, I can start. I think the issue of whether this case is, the nature of this case is quite different. In a sense, yes, but from the point of view of the government, how important was Dracula versus the transnational motorway? I believe my research shows that from their point of view, at that point in time, Dracula was very important. They you know, the prime minister invested in shares. He came on national television. You know, it was a big thing for them. They invested externally. They thought that that's going to transform Romania's image abroad. You know. So, yeah, from our point of view, they might not seem, Dracula Park may not seem so important or that, but I think for the government or the executive actors involved in this at that time, these were important cases. Whether the nature, because a motorway case is something that, you know, Romania needs transportation infrastructure, and I think on this issue, even the NGOs themselves were divided, and they mobilized too late, and they did too little. Partly because the contract had already been signed. So there is something they might have been able to do at the stage of environmental impact assessment, but they were overwhelmed by Bechtel. I mean, they just couldn't deal with the technical knowledge, expertise that was required. But there is a trans-European, there is a network of NGOs that mobilizes against the trans-European network. So they could have drawn on that, and I think they did try at some point, but again, it was a bit too late. However, even if they would have mobilized, I think if the Commission itself sort of lost on this, and the accession conditionality was the influence of accession conditionality was waning, I think even if they would have mobilized the way they did in erosion, I don't think they would have had much success. As for distrust, that's a very good question, and I too have been wondering about it. And I think in the case of Romania, I think it goes to the heart of the sort of the culture, the societal. I mean, certainly Romania had a stronger legacy. The communist legacy is much stronger in Romania than, because Ceausescu was. That's right. That's right. I agree.
I don't understand why in 20 years we have not been able to overcome that with our international capacity. That is a question. Why did
I know. It's so difficult. I mean, I don't want to get personal on this, but, you know, I'm Romanian and I live in Romania most of my life. So I came to this country and it took me 15 years. I'm very well integrated into a sort of the English middle class, if you want. But you need that close contact with a culture that appreciates, it's more consensual for that change to happen. So yes, I think there is collaboration with the transnational NGOs and all that, but I don't think that's enough. You know, it takes a long time to. And
you
also,
think you need people.
Please, we've got to get a number of other speakers in. So
sure.
Just
yeah.
One clarification: you mean you need people for a long time?
I think you need not that. Yes, or Romanians to socialize with the Western culture that we think is superior, to really take on, and that takes a lot of time, a long period of time for that to change.
Okay, others around the table.
Well, there was this issue about race, whether we should trust compliance data. well, that's a big issue for a long time. And of course there are things such as this grace period after accession, but Liana was pointing to the fact that, well, basically the pace, how the number of infringements increases is quite high still. So and if you compare to what happened in Greece, of course in the first years there was not so much on, but then it sort of took on. That's about the complaints that I also, as a Romanian, also want to want to get into this issue about the civil, like, why is this not working in the civil society area. And I think one of the issues is also this projectification of work. So this is the sort of this tied monies on short-term contracts. This is what you were talking about, that okay, like there are for the first time people in the Greenpeace office working for 2 or 3 years consecutively, because there has been a tremendous change in this period of time, and people moving in and out NGOs being one of the, you know, like businesses where you could make a living, but you also needed some other ones, and this is of course we need to think about the perverse effects of external actors here, but at the same time I'm perfectly I know about the difficulties how like actors like the Commission would face, like how should they build a project which goes for 10 years. So this is about accountability, transparency, and all these issues, and then it collides with local realities, of course. So but I think this issue of you know, like project-based thinking is one very, very important issue which really determines the day-by-day practices, how these organizations work.
Liam, any comments?
Yes, well, I'm not going to comment further on the compliance issue, but I wanted to comment a little bit on that comparison between two different regulatory areas. Am I comparing apples and oranges by looking at the issue area where the industry is kind of dependent on certain markets and needs those regulations, and then the NGOs? We did that in part to illuminate different mechanisms of transnational network influence. And the case of the industry, chemical industry in Bulgaria, they didn't just wake up in 1992 and decide, now we are entering the European Union, how great it will be to adopt all these environmental regulations so that we look good and we don't have problems with exporting our products. What is interesting is that legwork was done by this transnational network that was very strongly centered on the European Federation of Chemical Industry and chose all sorts of allies, including Commission, member states, and domestic government officials. And then your question about different industry-state relations are very important, because that's the difference between the Bulgarian and the Romanian case, where just from the perspective of network analysis, you would have expected the same kind of network would be exported to Romania as it was in Bulgaria and Poland and the Czech Republic and Hungary, but it was not exported to the same extent. So there are domestic limiting conditions that need to be exported further. By contrast, very interesting in the chemical regulations is where you in theory have the potential for an NGO network to be very active watchdog. It isn't. There are several NGO networks working on chemical issues at the Brussels level, but those networks are very focused on European Union policy for chemicals. And so as a result, the issues on compliance and domestic implementation is off the radar screen. So in these societies, there's very limited network activity, watchdog network activity. So the industry carries the weight. So what we are trying to argue that European integration is the interplay between networks and intergovernmentalism, and you cannot separate the two, and still, via different pathways, stronger networks have different kinds of impact. We have a little bit of a problem in the dependent variable, because on one hand, we expect stronger networks, more infringement. In the other way, we expect stronger networks, less infringement because of capacity. But nevertheless, I mean, if we get around to explaining why it's acceptable to consider implementation and compliance processes as processes as opposed to just outcomes, we may be able to get around that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your comment about early 90s parties, it's true, and parties typically associated with EGP, they have two camps. The first camp is the kind of dedicated Green Party, having the green label in the name, sort of activist party, going for the niche, the environmental niche. The other kind of party is the larger party fighting for democracy, rights, being to some extent anti-system, contesting all parties, corruption, so having like a broader agenda. And those parties who have broader agendas, they tend to perform better in the elections, rather than those who are going for the niche, the environmental niche. And also, they tend to have kind of a more distant relationship with the EGP, because EGP also goes for the core green environmental policies in relation with these parties, rather than, let's say, contesting the political system as such. But of course, I want to look earlier in the 90s. I've been focusing on the last 4 or 5 years. But DOM is an interesting example. They are always present at their EGP councils, and they want to improve their relations. Regarding the rules of the game, indeed, the European Green Party has this new system of preventing concentration of power. They have two chairperson, woman and man, and they kind of promote this at the level of Green Parties and CE. They are informally pushing for quotas for nominations, but this is not a formal requirement. It's more informal. So there is also kind of a transfer of techniques to this kind of parties. In terms of example, lessons learned. I said that the EGP is very is becoming increasingly demanding in regards to or with the parties, but it's not entirely true, because they know what the kind of challenges the Green parties have to face in this country, because the party politics is overall more corrupt, and it's more difficult to assert yourself politically and electorally. But I can say there are some things that the Green parties from Central and Eastern Europe are uploading to the European level. They're very they're active on the internet, for example, social media. For example, LNP and even the Romanian parties, they are doing great on Facebook. Not at the polls, but great on Facebook. So actually, Central Eastern European webmasters and online coordinators, they're participating in workshops saying, look, we've done great, and somehow, you know, we have to cope with our situation, so we need to be creative. And some of the solutions, they can work also for the Europeans.
Great. Well, we're running out of time, so I'm going to take a group of three questions. I have two already available, and I see I'll stretch it to four. If you make them quick, please. Professor Buzzer.
I have a comment on Liana, and then a question for actually Liana, Christina, and Aaron. Try to be brief. Liana, I think your findings don't necessarily contradict so much the general, you know, trend in the literature to argue that it's weak states and weak societies, because I think it depends a lot what your reference point is. Mm-hmm. I think the further you climb down the Satori ladder of abstraction, the more variation, of course, you find. Mm-hmm. And what we did in this Acta Politica is we compared it to Western Europe. And there you can, I think, make the point. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that state and society capacity cannot vary across sectors, for instance, and I think that's clearly Aaron's point. And also, it depends on the type of actors you look at. I just wanted to clarify that. And You know, and I find your work extremely interesting because one of the three mechanisms that we've identified by which Europeanization impacts civil society in Central Eastern Europe is actually networks. It's money, rights, and networks. And so again, and then the question is, what is your dependent variable? We looked at empowerment of civil society. You seem to be focus more on compliance. So all I'm saying is, I think we don't necessarily contradict that much. So now the question, because I think Christina's paper is extremely important because it sort of introduces some variation. I mean, nobody denies that transnational networks can have a positive impact. The question is on what. But you actually show that, you know, they can also have not an impact, or at some level, some dark side.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that points to the danger of a selection bias on your dependent variable if you only focus on success cases. And Christina, I think, has painted a more nuanced picture, which of course then begs the questions of scope conditions. So under which conditions do transnational networks actually have an impact on compliance or whatever? I think Aaron's paper then, that would be the question, what extent states, what you call state-society relations, which vary again, it can vary across sectors, is one potential scope condition. I think that's what you argue in your paper and your dissertation, who I have the pleasure to supervise, by the way. And all the type of actors Miranda mentioned, right? I mean, does it make a difference whether we talk about transnational networks comprising business actors or NGOs?
Okay,
I'm Shahada Mdespe from the University of Southampton. I have two questions, one for Aaron and the other one for Claudio. Aaron, when I was looking at your discussion about the external domestic cooperation, and you referred there mainly at the cooperation between the European Commission and the new member states, I was wondering if you looked at all at the cooperation between Hungary and Romania, especially on water policies, especially after the Baia-Mare accident. So to what extent the cooperation which has started after 2000 on river basins would influence your data on compliance with regards to water policy directives? So whether you would consider looking at these two states operating together. And the other question for Claudio, you've just mentioned now at the end the idea of electoral success, and I can't help myself asking, you know, why are the Green parties in Eastern Europe seeking membership in the European Green Party? Well, because of legitimacy, visibility, and so on. But has this in turn become concrete in terms of their electoral success at the domestic level? I mean, does this bring any gains, and have you seen any evidence of that, of any electoral gain as a result of their membership? Because they've been members for almost a decade now, most of them, and so I'm wondering if that paid off.
Okay. Lisa.
Hi, thank you. My name is Maša Perović. I'm from Serbia, and I'm involved with a movement that's called Let's Do It World. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's a regional cleanup grassroots movement. We started in Latvia 2008, where 50,000 volunteers were recruited in one day to clean the whole country. I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's an amazing movement that's now in kind of spread out through Europe, and it's kind of starting in Serbia, hopefully. I just wanted to make you aware of it. I think it's an amazing grassroots thing that shows that, you know, people can actually do things even though it takes some time.
I haven't resigned because your comments. I just wanted to comment on your paper on case studies in Romania, and I thought it was very interesting. I thought it was a picture not only of how civil society or the transnational civil society changed, but more of how the perception and the understanding of the Romanian government changed through the process of the accession preparations. Their vision of the EU certainly changed through the years, and you pointed out in these studies. You raised the question of whether or not the external pressure
actually was non-democratic, whether this was in fact going against what the EU was trying to promote in terms of promoting democracy in the country. And that in fact was one of our concerns inside of DG Environment, that we were under a lot of pressure to oppose projects that perhaps were not what we personally would have seen as good environmental choices. But our line was always very much pushing back to the Romanian government precisely because these weren't things that were under EU competence, and that we felt that these were decisions that were the competence of the Romanian government. So that very much influenced our reaction to these two cases, the Bratislava and the Roșia Montană. The one way, though, that we did see that you could promote both environmental ends and promote democracy was through the application of EIA. You didn't mention earlier, you mentioned just at the end, and I wanted to underline that I see EIA actually as more a tool for promoting good governance and democracy than for promoting environment per se, but it brings the two strands together. And so that's perhaps where I would see international action promoting the two ends at the same time. Just companies saying, no, this is not a good project, you shouldn't do it because we externally don't like it, it doesn't fit our notion of good environmental management. No, that's not good democracy. But coming in and saying, have you done the proper EIA? Have you considered the impacts? Have you looked at all the implications? And please take an informed choice. That's promoting democracy.
Thank you. Well, I'll give an opportunity to all of the speakers to respond. If you could keep it brief, as I think everyone's now waiting for lunch. But Aaron,
you go. Good point. But looking to basically to horizontal networks, obviously there is a lot of there. We heard about like horizontal network in between NGOs, but there is also learning going on among states. And obviously the water is a good issue because waters don't stop at borders. I did quite a lot of interviews with people based in this common river basins, but that didn't really end up into this framework, which is sort of tries to understand. But it's a very good hint and would be worth looking into that, because I think the EU is doing it. When you look at Ukraine and further out, this is a good way to promote, even if a soft way to promote kinds of governance principles.
I agree with the question of under what conditions. That's an important question. Transnational networks will have an impact, and I think one we need to sort of define what we mean by impact and what we mean by power, because there might be, for example, in my cases, there are sort of extreme cases where the NGOs totally overturn government, for example, in drug club world, but there might be softer ways of influencing policy making. And my assumption was that if NGOs had an influence in these extreme cases where you wouldn't have expected them to have an influence, then you can assume that there is more influence there that I haven't tried to capture. And I totally agree with your point. And I think the European Commission was quite cautious, and they did generally emphasize the environmental impact assessment and all that. And I think perhaps the more political pressure came through the European Parliament, where they are politicians, so they don't have to maintain a sort of any surface of neutrality or anything like that. And I think some of the pressure that came perhaps through the Commission, the Commission be very careful with the language it used. They'll say we are monitoring, but there is perhaps sometimes, or at least certainly the Romanian government read between the lines that meant more than, that made them proceed quite cautiously because they didn't quite know what would happen if anything goes wrong. I think I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thank you. Why the Green parties are behaving so poorly? Okay, that's the big question. And secondly, what is the membership in the EGP brings them? First, I would say that the party systems in Eastern Europe are not in flux anymore. 20 years is enough. I think we know their structure. There's greenwashing from major parties, because the Ministry of Environment, it's a very valuable portfolio, a lot of money, so all of the big parties, they have green platforms. There is contestation from NGOs, fearing that they will lose their representation of like the green interest in the country. And if I would have to bet on something, I would say that it is the lack of local power. The green parties in Central and Eastern Europe, they're not based on grassroots community level agendas, but they're rather expressions of young, progressive, very urban elites. These are the kind of groups who are supporting green parties in the Eastern Europe, and not, let's say, the local level people. And secondly, what could bring the EGP membership? Well, in this specific case, I don't think they will change the fortune of a party. For example, in 2009, they sent letters of endorsement to Hungary and Bulgaria. In one case, in Hungary, worked with LMP, but with Zelenite in Bulgaria, it didn't work at all. What it can do, EGP, is to lift the one party that is a member, or becomes a member, out of relative marginality and bring it, let's say, on the radar. And possibly, they can make that party, even small, a potential coalition partner for major parties. For example, Social Democrats, Liberals, or other kind of parties. So they can influence, I think, the fortunes of a party, not making it big, but at least lift the party from marginality and bring it to the table, so. Thank you.
Thanks. And
Lea, any final? Great, a few final words. Well, thanks, Tanya, for bringing this point. I do agree that the finding is not necessarily contradictory, but it raises the bigger point. What is civil society?
Mm-hmm.
So on one hand, I wouldn't...
just a slightly bigger point.
I understand that people are hungry. It's 1 o'clock. But if we just measure associational activity, yes, associational activity in Eastern Europe is lower than associational activity in Western Europe, and there are a variety of reasons for that. But there are other forms of societal activity, including more professionalized kind of NGOs, which are becoming very powerful policy interlocutors, not only in Eastern Europe, but in advanced industrialized countries. Look at the NGO and landscape in the United States. It has also transformed substantially towards greater professionalization, service work, and so on and so forth. And second of all, what about this, the transnationalization of civil society and these grassroots networks that appear? And I was just trying to make the point that we don't know sufficiently about this aspect of civil society, and the special issue in active politics is very important because it brought in the issue, which we kind of have forgotten as a result of the obsession with conditionality and succession. And now it opens up a Pandora box to examine more deeply what exactly civil society means in the context of transition and post-transition for the environment. So I'll just leave it here.
Lovely, thank you very much. Just a quick thing, in your packs you'll see that you have a couple of papers which have been produced by LISI, which is our research unit on Southeast Europe. But I'd like to also draw your attention to this publication on the financial crisis in Southeast Europe. There's plenty of copies available there. Please feel free to pick any of them up. On that note, thank you very much, all of you, and to the speakers and to the discussants. And I believe Adam will make a quick announcement, a housekeeping announcement.
Yes, a quick housekeeping announcement. If you're one of our in the audience, then you have the luxury of having an alfresco lunch wherever you please. If you're a paper giver or an invited guest, you have to be institutionalised, and you need a luncheon voucher, which I have here. So if, regardless of your status, we aim to be back here just on two, because we've got another big cram-packed session.
Lovely. Okay, thank, great. You thank you very much, all.
Sure. Thank you.